Umi and went to work. My eyes were on the cat, but slowly my vision of him changed. In fact, my eyesight changed completely. The cat's orange color muted to gray in my vision, while the pattern on his coat suddenly sharpened. I noticed more nuance and detail in the tabby pattern than I had before. Meanwhile, everything looked incredibly bright, as though the lights had been turned up. I blinked a few times to try to clear up that sensation, and noticed I was getting closer and closer to the ground. Something fell over my face, obscuring my sight, and I wiggled out from under it. It was my shirt. Looking back at the mirror, I found myself regarding the reflections of two cats. One of them was me.
"Well, I'll be damned."
I didn't recognize the voice as Adrian's right away. I was still human enough to understand language, but my new ears processed sounds in an entirely different way. In particular, I heard more of them, and ordinary noises from before seemed louder. I had little time to ponder this as two hands suddenly scooped me up and pushed me into the cat carrier. The door shut.
"We don't want to get them mixed up,"
Mr. Williker said.
"Where are you going to put the other one?"
asked Daniela.
"Wherever you like,"
said Ms. Terwilliger.
"I can't take him with me. The guards saw me come in with one cat. They'll see me leave with one."
"What?"
My mother-in-law's voice came out extra shrill to my ears.
"That creature's staying?"
It figured. Her daughter-in-law transforming into an animal? No problem. Having to take care of a cat? Crisis.
"I'll pick you guys up a litter box and some cat food,"
said Neil helpfully. Through the metal grating on my carrier door, Adrian's face suddenly appeared, peering in at me.
"What's new, pussycat? You okay in there?"
Out of habit, I tried to answer, but all that came out was a half-meow. The world suddenly whirled around me as the carrier lifted in the air, forcing me to scramble to keep my balance with both feet and senses that were foreign.
"No time for chit-chat," said Ms. Terwilliger. "We need to move."
Adrian must have followed her because his face appeared again through the door.
"Be careful, Sage. I love you."
Ms. Terwilliger and Eddie made their farewells and headed out the door. We walked through the building and then outside. I knew from an earlier clock that it was still nighttime, but the world I was able to see through the gaps in the carrier looked wholly different from what I was used to. The scattered lampposts more than lit up the darkness to my enhanced vision, and even if I didn't see a full range of colors, I could see much farther than my human eyes ever could have. We had at least an hour on the spell's longevity, but my companions kept up a good pace, walking briskly through the court's grounds to visitor parking. There, Ms. Terwilliger reclaimed the rental car she'd driven in and set my carrier in the back seat. It gave me a poor view of our surroundings, but still allowed me to hear everything. At the main gate, guardians interrogated Ms. Terwilliger about her visit, wanting to know why Eddie was with her.
"I'm currently on leave,"
he responded in a way that was brisk but not defensive.
"I've got personal matters to take care of, and she offered me a ride."
"I know the roads outside your court aren't always friendly in the dark,"
Ms. Terwilliger added,
"so I don't mind the company."
"Wait, and the sun'll be up in less than an hour,"
said the guardian.
"No time,"
she replied.
"I have a flight to catch."
As Adrian had predicted, the guardian searched the car thoroughly, and I heard one of them whisper to the other,
"Make sure there are no stowaways."
My anxiety rose, and I found myself experiencing the strange sensation of whipping my tail back and forth. A Dompier face appeared before me, and he made some clicking sounds.
"Hey, kitty, kitty."
I made no response, afraid it might come out as a hiss. The guardians finally cleared us, and like that, we were on the road, free of the place that had been both a sanctuary and prison for the last month. Mr. Williger drove us another half hour to put distance between us and court, and then pulled the car off on the shoulder of a rural highway. Once parked, she opened up the carrier so that I could come out onto the back seat, and she set a pile of clothes beside me. Beyond her, I could barely discern the sky lightening.
"There you go,"
she said, moving back to the front seat.
"I should probably have told you before. It's a lot easier going into this spell than it is coming out of it."
Chapter 3. Adrian. Minutes felt like hours after Sydney's departure. I paced the length of our small suite, a knot in my chest as I braced myself for the worst. Any second now, I feared, I would get word that the plan had gone awry, and guardians had intercepted Sydney trying to escape court.
"Darling, must you do that?" my mother asked at last. "You're agitating the animals."
I paused and glanced down to where Mr. Bojangles was keeping a wary eye on Hopper, the small enchanted dragon that Sydney had summoned earlier this year. Hopper had become a pet of sorts and was regarding the cat with an excitement that clearly wasn't reciprocated.
"I don't think it's me, Mom. They're just..."
A chime from my phone interrupted me, and I dove for it, startling both cat and dragon. On my phone's display, a text message from Eddie was clear and succinct. "Made it out of court. All is well." I texted back. "Am I still married to a cat?" "Yes," came the response, followed a moment later by, "But Ms. T swears it's temporary." Some of my anxiety lessened, but not all. I wrote, "Let me know when she's back." 20 minutes later, a new message came in, this one from Sydney herself. "Back in human form, everything seems to be normal." "Everything?" I questioned. "Well, aside from a weird urge to chase laser pointers," she responded. "If that's the worst effect, I'll take it. Keep me posted. I love you." "I meow you too," she wrote back. It was promptly corrected with, "I mean, I love you." I smiled as I put the phone away, but found I was still a long way from feeling as though all was right in the world. I couldn't shake the feeling that things weren't entirely settled between Sydney and me. And that wasn't even taking into consideration the physical threat she now faced. She'd made it outside of court, but was now potentially facing all the same dangers that had driven us to seek sanctuary here.
"Only if they know she's out," Aunt
Tatiana's voice reminded me, in a rare moment of legitimate helpfulness.
"As long as no one's looking for her, and she doesn't get discovered, she'll be safe. So don't blow it."
"Right," I agreed. "And no one will have any reason to think she's not here. She never leaves our suite, and we don't really have that many visitors." Later that day, of course, we had a visitor. Thankfully, it wasn't a regiment of guardians demanding to know Sydney's whereabouts. Instead, I found Sonia Carp Tanner standing outside our door, smiling when she saw me. Whatever relief I found at seeing her was quashed by an anxious Aunt Tatiana.
"Don't let your guard down at any cost," she hissed.
"Sonia's our friend," I silently replied. Aunt Tatiana disagreed.
"It doesn't matter. No one can know Sydney's gone, no matter how friendly you think they are. All it takes is one little slip, no matter how good the intention. The fewer the people who know a secret, the better."
With a pang, I realized she was right. Meanwhile, Sonia's congenial expression had turned puzzled as I conducted my mental conversation with the phantom.
"Are you okay, Adrian?" asked Sonia.
"Fine, fine," I said, beckoning her in. "Just tired. I had kind of a rough morning." I gestured vaguely at my face, which still bore the signs of scuffling with Wesley and his crew. As I'd hoped, Sonia was effectively deflected. Concern lit her features.
"What happened?"
"Oh, the usual. Just some idiots jealous of me being married to the hottest human around."
"Where is she?"
asked Sonia, glancing around the empty suite. "And your mother?"
"Mom went to bed,"
I replied, "and Sydney, she's out for a walk." Sonia's sharp eyes focused back on me.
"She's out after you were attacked this morning?"
"Well, it's daylight out, so there's less of a threat. And Neil's with her." I nearly said Eddie, but wasn't sure if Sonia might have heard about him leaving court. Knowing my luck now, Neil would stop by unannounced and ruin the story. "She needed some air," I added, seeing Sonia's skeptical look. Staying cooped up inside is really getting to her. That, at least, wasn't a lie. Sonia held my gaze a few more moments before finally deciding to let the topic go. She could probably tell from my aura and body language that I wasn't being entirely honest, but it was unlikely she could guess the truth, that Sydney had transformed into a cat and been smuggled out of court in a far-fetched attempt to find Jill. "Well, it's you I came to see," Sonia said at last. "I need to discuss something with you, or rather, someone." I sat down at our kitchen table and nodded for her to do the same. "Discuss someone?" I could do that, as long as it wasn't Sydney. "Who do you have in mind?" I asked. Sonia laced her fingers together and took a deep breath. "Nina Sinclair." I winced. Perhaps not as problematic as Sydney right now, but Nina was by no means a welcome topic. She was a spirit user, like me, one I'd been pretty good friends with while Sydney had been in captivity. Unfortunately, Nina had wanted to be much better friends and had been reading more into our relationship than there was. She'd taken my rejection badly, and had responded even worse when she found out I'd married a human. On the rare times I'd passed her since returning to court, I was constantly reminded of the old, "if looks could kill" adage. "What about Nina?" I asked carefully. "Is she still working for you?" Sonia was the leader on a project attempting to use spirit to prevent people from turning Strigoi. Nina had inadvertently helped with this initially when she'd restored her sister, Olive, from being a Strigoi. With several of us working together, we'd managed to transfer that spirit magic to Neil's blood, effectively creating a vaccine that protected Neil from ever being forcibly turned. Sonia's victory had been short-lived, however, as she was unable to replicate that effect in anyone else. But she was still tirelessly working toward that goal. "Technically, yes, but it's been a while since she truly offered anything of value." Sonia's expression darkened. "Nina's been a little off lately." I couldn't help a small laugh at that. "We're spirit users. We're all a little off." Sonia didn't return my smile. "Not like this. If you could see her, well, you'd understand. I sent her home yesterday because she wasn't making any sense. She also looked as though she hadn't slept in weeks. The only spirit user I've seen in such bad shape was, well, the time I interviewed Avery Lazar." That drew me up short. Avery, another spirit user, was currently in the mental facility of a Moroi prison. "Avery used ridiculous amounts of spirit," I reminded her. "I mean, ridiculous, and on a regular basis." Bringing back Jill had taken its toll on me, temporarily draining me of spirit, but it had been a one-time thing. Avery had attempted a number of high-power feats over and over, landing her in her current state where her mind finally couldn't take any more. Nina would have to be doing some pretty serious magic to end up like that. "That's exactly what I'm afraid of," said Sonia grimly. I gasped, thinking of Avery. "That she's trying to acquire shadow-kissed bondmates?" "No, not that. But something that takes almost as much power and is being done on a regular basis. Whenever I try to get an answer out of her, she evades me or just starts babbling nonsense." Sonia sighed. "I'm worried about her, Adrian. She needs help, but she won't talk to me." As the pointed silence grew, I suddenly caught on to what Sonia was getting at. "What? You think she'll talk to me?" Sonia shrugged. "I don't know who else to ask." "Well, not me," I exclaimed. "She was furious when I turned her down. If she's got something going on and needs help, I'm not the one she's going to turn to. You need to ask someone else." "There is no one else. Her sister's still missing. And did you know Nina quit her office job? Or, actually, I think she was fired, but it's hard to get a straight answer out of her. As far as I know, you and I are the only ones around who care about what she's doing to herself, and we need to step up and help her." "She won't talk to me," I reiterated. Sonia raked a hand through her dark red hair. "You might be surprised. Even though things fell out between you, she clearly still felt as though there was some connection. Please, Adrian, please just try. If she sends you away, fine. So be it. I won't ask you again." I started to say no once more, but a closer look at Sonia stopped me. She truly was agitated by this. It was in her voice and eyes, even in the colors of her aura. I knew Sonia wasn't the type to overreact. I also knew she wouldn't ask this of me if she wasn't truly concerned, especially since she was the one who'd advised me to stay away from Nina to protect her feelings. I glanced at the time. It was growing late by our standards. Most Maroi would be going to bed. Okay if I wait to see her until tomorrow? Sonia considered, and then gave a small nod. I'm sure that'll be fine. Of course, I'm also sure she probably won't be asleep anytime soon. But it may be best if you wait for Sydney to get back before leaving, so that Neil can accompany you. For a moment, I nearly said that Eddie was with Sydney, not Neil, and then I remembered the cover story. I'd have to get in touch with Neil to make sure he backed up what I said. If I wasn't careful, things could get very complicated very quickly. It was what I hated most about lying. It rarely stayed simple. Sounds good, I said, standing as Sonia did. I'll let you know how it goes.
Thank you. I know this isn't...
She bit her words off as Mr. Bojangles came tearing through the room, with Hopper in hot pursuit. Sonia turned to me, startled.
When did you get a cat?
Today, actually. Jackie Terwilliger, Sydney's old teacher, left it when she visited. That was obviously news to Sonia.
She was here? At court? How long did she stay?
Not long, I said, immediately wishing I hadn't mentioned it at all. Just checking up on Sydney.
That's a lot of effort just to check up on someone. A phone call would have been simpler.
I hoped I looked guileless. Yeah, but then she wouldn't have been able to give us the cat. Belated wedding gift.
Adrian, said Sonia, using the voice she must have used to chastise countless students when she was a high school biology teacher. What aren't you telling me?
Nothing, nothing, I said, steering her to the door. Relax, we're all fine. The only thing you need to worry about is how fast Nina's going to send me packing.
Adrian, everything's fine, I said cheerily.
I opened the door for her. Thanks for stopping by. Say hi to Mikhail for me. It was clear from her expression that I'd completely failed in convincing her of my innocence, but at least she looked like she wasn't going to compel me to tell her what was really going on, for now. We made our farewells, and I breathed a sigh of relief when she was gone, hoping no one else would come by and force me to fumble for another excuse about why Sydney wasn't around. I went to bed soon thereafter, and was awakened midday by a new text message from Sydney. She reported that she, Eddie, and Jackie had made it to Pittsburgh, but wouldn't be truly investigating the museum until nightfall. She assured me everything was fine, and I assured her of the same, deciding it was probably best if she didn't know I'd agreed to go talk to a potentially crazy girl who was either in love with me or despised everything about me. Sydney had enough to worry about. When the Maroi court began waking up later in the day, I managed to get Neil to come back and walk me over to Nina's. It was early enough that not too many people were out, but I figured it was better to be safe than sorry. Neil, driven by duty, was happy to help me regardless, but I knew he had an ulterior interest in going with me to see Nina. Months ago, he and her sister, Olive, had had the beginnings of a romance blossoming. None of us were entirely sure how far it had gone, but things had ended abruptly when Olive had taken off, with little contact with Nina, and none with Neil. I doubted Nina had any new details on her sister's whereabouts, but Neil was probably hoping for some scrap of info. The late summer sun was still well above the horizon, even around 6, when we reached Nina's door. She lived in a section of bare-bones apartments, inhabited by other court employees, or ex-employees, as it turned out, far from the much more posh lodgings that royals like my father lived in. I took a deep breath as I stared at that door, summoning my courage. "It won't get any easier if you put it off," Neil told me, unhelpfully. "I know." Resolved, I gave 2 short raps to the door, secretly hoping Nina was asleep or not at home. Then I could honestly tell Sonia I'd tried and leave it at that. Unfortunately, Nina opened the door almost immediately, as though she'd been waiting right by it.
"Hello, Adrian," she said warily. Her gray eyes lifted beyond me. "Neil?"
He gave a nod of greeting, but I was momentarily stunned. Nina didn't come from a rich or royal background, but that had never affected her beauty, and she'd always presented herself in an immaculate manner.
At least, she used to. That Nina I'd known was nowhere in sight. Her dark curly hair looked as though it hadn't been brushed recently. In fact, I wasn't sure it had been washed in a while either. A rumpled blue plaid skirt clashed with an orange t-shirt, over which she wore an inside-out gray cardigan. One of her feet was covered with a white ankle sock. Her other sock, adorned with red and white stripes, came up to her knee. And yet, it wasn't the bizarre wardrobe choice that was most alarming. Instead, it was the look on her face that told me Sonia hadn't been exaggerating. Dark circles hung under Nina's eyes, though the eyes themselves were bright and almost too alert, glittering feverishly. It was a look I'd seen before in Spirit Users Pushed to the Edge. It was a look I'd seen on Avery Lazar's face. I swallowed. "Hello, Nina? Can we come in?" Her eyes narrowed. "Why? So you can tell me again how totally unsuitable we are? So you can tell me how we can never, ever possibly work out, seeing as I'm not human and you apparently only hook up with people who double as dinner?" My temper started to flare at the slight, but then I reminded myself that she wasn't well. "I'm sorry for what I said last time. I mean it. I'd met Sydney long before I met you, but that's not what I'm here to talk about. Please, can we come in?" Nina stared at me wordlessly for a long time, and I used the opportunity to call on Spirit and sneak a glimpse of her aura. Like Lys's yesterday, Nina's aura was filled with the pale gold of a Spirit user. Unlike Lys's, however, Nina's gold had a weak, almost watery quality to it. It didn't burn like a flame. The other colors were equally frail, flickering in and out. "Okay," she said at last. She stepped aside and let us pass. What I found inside was nearly as disconcerting as her appearance. I'd been to her place before, back when she and I had done a lot of party hopping together. The tiny apartment was actually more of a studio, with bedroom and living room merged into one. Despite the small size, Nina had always gone to great pains to keep her home tidy and well-decorated. Much like the care given to her physical exterior, though, that upkeep seemed to be a thing of the past. Crusty, smelly dishes were piled high in the kitchen sink, where a couple of flies buzzed lazily. Laundry, books, and cans of energy drink were piled everywhere. Tables, floor, even the bed. Weirdest of all was a stack of magazines on the floor, with a pile of shredded paper next to them. "How do you sleep?" I asked, unable to help myself. "I don't," she said, clasping her hands behind her back. "I don't. There's no time. I can't risk it." "You have to sleep sometime," said Neil pragmatically. She shook her head frantically. "I can't. I have to keep trying to find Olive. I mean, I found her, kind of. Depends on how you look at it. But I can't get to her, you see? That's the problem. That's why I have to keep trying. Why I can't sleep. Understand?" I didn't understand at all, but Neil's breath had caught at the mention of Olive's name. "You found her? You know where she is?" "No," said Nina, sounding slightly irritated. "I just told you that." Without warning, she flounced down on the floor beside the magazine pile. She picked a magazine up at random and began tearing it, page by page, into tiny little pieces, building up the pile of shreddings. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Thinking," she replied. "No, I mean with the magazines." "This helps me think," she explained. Neil and I exchanged glances. "Nina," I said carefully, "I think maybe you should go visit a doctor. Neil and I can go with you, if you'd like." "I can't," she protested, still methodically shredding the magazine. "Not until I reach Olive." I crouched down beside her, wishing I had a better idea of how to talk to someone so clearly unstable. You'd think I'd be an expert. "How are you trying to reach her? By phone?" "By dream," said Nina. "I succeeded, a couple of times, but then she blocked me. She turned the dream against me. I'm trying to fight through it, but I can't." I could tell from Neil's expression that he was hoping that had made sense to me, but I was more confused than ever. A particularly resistant person could make it difficult for a spirit user to form a dream connection, but the rest made no sense. "Olive's not a spirit user," I told her. "She can't do anything to the dream without your permission. You wield the ultimate control." She can. Nina began tearing up the magazine with renewed energy. Each time I try to talk to her, she throws up some obstacle. Things I never even thought of. Her nightmares, my nightmares, someone's. I fight them. I do. Really, I do, but it takes so much spirit.
She abruptly stopped the shredding and stared off into space bleakly.
It's exhausting, and by the time I get through, she's slipped away. She wakes herself up, and I can't talk to her. Can't ask her why she left me. Do you know?
Nina's eyes flitted from me to Neil.
Do you know why she left?
No, I said gently. All I know is that you need some serious rest. I started to put a hand on her shoulder, and she jerked away, anger glinting in her eyes.
Don't torment me, she said in a low voice. Don't come here and act like you're my friend.
I am your friend, Nina. No matter what happened or didn't happen between us, I'm your friend. I want to help you. Her anger instantly flipped to despair.
No one can help me. No one can... Wait!
Unexpectedly, she grabbed my arm, her fingers digging in with astonishing and uncomfortable strength.
Maybe you can help me. You're the best dreamer. Come with me the next time I visit Olive. Then you'll see. You'll see how she's controlling the dream. If we combine our powers, maybe we'll be strong enough to stop her. Then we can talk to her.
I shook my head. Nina, there's no way she can... Those fingers bit deeper into my arm.
She is, Adrian. Join me and you'll see.
I thought carefully before responding. Nina was right about me being the best spirit dreamer that we knew of, and I'd never seen any sign of a non-spirit user being able to take control of a dream. Nina clearly believed that was the case and that it was preventing her from making contact with Olive. I didn't dare say it, but I wondered if Nina had been using so much spirit lately that her control was faltering. That would explain why she was having difficulty forging a dream connection, and in her addled state, she'd come up with the idea that Olive was interfering.
Yes, but what has she been using so much spirit on? Asked Aunt Tatiana.
It was a good question. Looking over Nina and her state of disarray, I found myself at a loss. Even if she tried to form a spirit dream connection with Olive every day, there was no way that alone could have driven Nina to this state. What else was she using magic on? Or was her mental deterioration being accelerated by something more than the magic? Was it a culmination of that and personal stress, like Olive's disappearance and my rejection?
Adrian? Asked Neil tentatively.
Isn't there any way you'd consider helping? Not knowing my thoughts, he believed my hesitation was over a refusal to offer assistance. The truth was, I just didn't know how. And honestly, Nina needed a lot more than help with a spirit dream. She needed help with her life.
Okay, I said at last. I'll help you connect to her in a dream, but only if you get some sleep.
Immediately, Nina began shaking her head.
I can't. I'm too excited. I have to keep looking. I have to...
You will get some sleep, I ordered. I'm getting Sonia here, and she's going to bring you a sedative. You will take it. And you will sleep.
Later, I will. Right now, we need to reach Olive. She's on a human schedule. She'll go to bed soon, and I can't be asleep. We'll reach her first, and...
No. No deal. I made my voice as firm and harsh as I could. If she's waited this long, she'll keep waiting. Sleep first.
For God's sake, Nina, look at yourself.
You're...
What?
What? She demanded, that earlier feverish look returning.
A mess? Ugly? Not good enough for you?
Exhausted, I sighed. Now please, let me call Sonia. You'll sleep today, and we'll look for Olive tomorrow. If you're rested, you'll be better able to, fight her control. I still didn't buy that, but Nina did, and she finally conceded.
Okay, she said. You can call Sonia.
I did, and Sonia was relieved to hear I'd made progress, small though it was. She promised to come over with something to help Nina sleep, and I promised to hang around until then. When I disconnected, Nina returned to her shredding and began humming what sounded like Sweet Caroline.
It's really nice of you to help her,
Neil murmured, coming to stand beside me across the room.
Sleep will do her good, and for my own selfish reasons, well, I admit I'm eager for you to have contact with Olive, too. Not that that's your primary reason for doing this.
Hey, it's a good enough reason. They all are.
I tried to keep my voice light, not letting on just how bothered I was by Nina's state. Because if I had to be honest, I wasn't doing this just for Neil, Sonia, or Nina. Watching Nina as she sat there humming, so clearly out of her mind, well, the truth was, it wasn't that hard to imagine myself in that state someday. And if it came to that, I hoped desperately that someone would help me, too.
Chapter 4. Sydney. I don't recommend turning into a cat. The actual experience of being a cat isn't too bad, but coming out of it? Awful. I felt as though I were being torn in two. My bones and skin stretched and twisted in ways that nature had never intended, and when it was all over, I felt beaten and bruised, like the time I'd fallen down a full flight of stairs as a child. A vaguely nauseous feeling settled in the pit of my stomach, and for a panicked moment, I thought I would throw up. Forced vomiting had been one of many punishments the alchemists had inflicted on me while I was in their captivity, and the very idea of it triggered a flood of unwelcome memories. Fortunately, the sensation soon passed, and I felt more or less like my former self.
"There's a great place to get coffee about 20 miles from here," Ms. Terwilliger said once I was settled and had my seatbelt on. "We'll stop there and get some gas before pushing on to Pittsburgh."
I nodded, finished a text to Adrian, and stretched my legs, still coming to terms with the return to my old body. Beside me in the seat sat the wooden box Ms. Terwilliger had brought, and I picked it up for a closer look. Free of its sealing enchantment, there was nothing extraordinary about it now. In the months since Jill's disappearance, there'd been a lot of speculation about who would have taken her. Almost always, we'd laid the blame on some Maroi dissident who didn't support Lyssa. Yet this clearly showed evidence of human magic, which kind of turned everything we'd believed upside down. Aside from me, we knew of no magic-using humans working with Maroi. I could only hope this museum offered some answers, as unlikely as it seemed. Inside the box, the words on that flyer glared up at me. "Come play, Sydney." Once we had our coffee, the drive passed uneventfully, with our only slowdown being summertime construction scattered along the highway. Honestly, it would have been a pleasant road trip, if not for the fact we were all still keyed up with worry and tension. I was worried Adrian might do something reckless back at court. And, of course, I was worried about Jill. Eddie clearly was, too. And rather than make him feel better, this new lead had only increased his agitation. He barely said two words to us the whole drive. We still made good time overall, rolling up to the Pittsburgh Robot Museum in late afternoon. A hand-painted sign declared that it was world-famous, but none of us had ever heard of it. Judging from the empty parking lot, not many people had.
"We're usually busier on weekends,"
explained the attendant at the admission window. We bought 3 tickets and stepped inside.
"Please come in. Please come in,"
boomed a robot standing near the entrance. It didn't move and had been patched with duct tape in a number of places. In its arms, it held a long rectangular welcome sign. The bulk of the museum was contained inside one large gallery that displayed a motley assortment of robots used in both entertainment and practical business applications. Most of the displays were static, but a few were animated, like a mini-assembly line showing a robot that checked for manufacturing quality control. A conveyor belt on an endless loop sent ceramic mugs around and around past a boxy-looking device that paused and scanned each one, flashing either red or green lights, depending on whether it found a defect. An adjacent room displayed a history of robotics along its walls. It included mythological origins, like automatons that served the Greek god Hephaestus, which I thought was a nice touch. The bulk of the timeline focused on developments in the 20th and 21st centuries, and then ended with, "The future?" ? I stared at those question marks a moment, thinking they might as well be a label for my own future. What did my life hold? Would I ever manage the college and world travel dreams I'd harbored for so long? Or would my life be limited to a suite of rooms surrounded by vampires? Was being on the run the best outcome I could hope for?
Sydney?
Mr. Williger's voice drew me from the timeline room, and I returned to the main gallery. She and Eddie were standing by a huge glass display case featuring what looked like a metal dinosaur more than twice my height. I recognized it as the one from the flyer beside which my name had been written. Mr. Williger's hand rested on the glass.
"Can you feel this?"
she asked me. I placed my hand next to hers and waited. After several seconds, I sensed some kind of buzzing energy. Eddie imitated us, but then shook his head.
"I don't feel anything,"
he said. "There's an enchantment on this display," Mr. Williger explained, stepping back. "Can you tell anything about it?" I asked. She was more sensitive to that sort of thing than I was. It was a skill that required practice.
"No, I need to open this case."
There was a small metal lock on the glass case that either of us probably could have opened with a spell. From what I could tell, there was no other security or electronic alarm on this display or the others. And I honestly wasn't surprised. Something told me this place didn't have the budget for anything too high-tech, ironically enough. As it was, it didn't even have air conditioning, making it hot and stuffy inside with only a few screened windows to provide ventilation.
"Ah,"
said the attendant, striding over to us. He'd probably grown bored at his post.
"I see you're admiring the raptor bot."
I glanced up at its metal teeth and red eyes.
"It's something else," I said honestly. "Are you fans of the movie?"
he asked. "What movie?" I asked.
"Raptorbot Rampage," said the attendant.
"Yes,"
said Eddie, almost reluctantly. Mr. Williger and I turned to him in surprise. He flushed under our scrutiny.
"What? It was kind of awesome. I saw it with Micah and Trey."
The attendant nodded eagerly.
"It's about a scientist whose wife is dying of an incurable disease. Just before she dies, he builds this robot raptor and manages to transfer her soul into it. Only things go unexpectedly awry when she goes off on a rampant killing spree."
"It couldn't have been that unexpected," I argued. "I mean, why did he build a dinosaur body for her? Why not something more human, or at least a more friendly animal?"
"Because then there wouldn't have been much of a movie,"
said Eddie. "There's still got to be a plausible backstory," I said. A wry smile crossed Eddie's features. And although the entire topic was absurd, I realized I'd hardly ever seen anything but a grim expression on his face since Jill had been taken.
"I don't think you can really sit down with a movie called Raptorbot Rampage and expect a plausible backstory,"
he said. The attendant looked offended.
"What are you suggesting? It was a fine piece of film. When the sequel comes out, people will be lined up out the doors to see this exhibit."
"Sequel?"
Eddie and I asked in unison. Mr. Williger cleared her throat.
"I'm sorry to interrupt, but how long are you open today?"
"Until 5,
said the attendant, still looking put out that I wasn't showing proper respect for the raptor bot.
"Thank you," she said. "I think we've seen all we need. It's been an enjoyable visit. Let's go, Sydney. Eddie."
Puzzled over her actions, we followed her out but didn't speak until we were in the car. "What's going on?" I asked.
"We need to come back tonight, after they're closed, and bust into that display."
She spoke in a prim and proper tone, not at all like she was suggesting breaking and entering.
"I figured there was no point in sticking around and making ourselves more memorable."
"We were probably his only customers today," I remarked. That'll make us memorable. That and having someone who's actually seen and liked Raptorbot Rampage.
Hey, warned Eddie. Don't judge until you've watched it.
We went into downtown Pittsburgh and booked a hotel, since presumably we'd be staying there overnight. A number of restaurants were within walking distance, and we found a nice place for dinner where we could almost pretend we were living a normal life. Even still, I could tell Eddie was restless. He offered to go on a walk with me after dinner, and for a moment, I was tempted. The historic part of downtown looked like it'd be fun to explore, and it was a perfect summer evening, warm and breezy. Then I thought about the alchemists finding me and locking me away again, forcing me to repeat their rhetoric and undergo their tortures. My chest grew tight, and I shook my head. I'll just wait in our room until we go back to the museum.
They don't know you're here, he said softly, watching me with a careful eye. And I wouldn't let any of them get near you anyway.
I shook my head. Better play it safe. When it was fully dark outside, we drove back to the Robot Museum and parked a few blocks away, making the rest of the journey on foot. Metal grates had been closed and locked in front of all the windows and doors, and a sign warned that there was an electronic alarm on the door.
No sign that the windows are rigged with an alarm, said Eddie
after inspecting it closely.
In fact, you can see that one of them's still open behind its metal grate, probably to air the place out.
Even though it was well into night, the summer heat and humidity were still going strong.
No cameras inside, and none that I see here either, added Ms. Terwilliger.
I guess they sunk all their budget into the Raptor bot, I said. Not that it seems to be bringing in the customers. Eddie's brief moment of levity earlier was long gone, and he made no response to my barb. Instead, he examined the metal grate in front of the open window, his expression steely.
If I pull hard enough, I might be able to break this lock.
No need to use up your strength, said Ms. Terwilliger. I'm sure I have a spell to open it.
And no need to use up your magic, I said, stepping forward. From the depths of my large purse, I pulled out a small vial. My time cooped up in our suite at court hadn't been entirely wasted. Thanks to our questionably moral friend Abe, I'd been able to get my hand on a number of the components that went into some of the alchemists' more common chemical compounds. I'd spent my long confinement building up a stockpile of useful things, including this one, which dissolved metal pretty handily. The metal grating was like a little gate that slid out from one side of the window and latched to a lock on the opposite side. It actually might have been tough for Eddie to break it, but a few drops of the solution on the latch melted it away, releasing the gate easily. We slid it open, exposing the window. Its glass was up, with only a screen between the contents of the museum and us. Eddie took out a pocket knife, quickly and efficiently cutting open the screen. I winced in spite of myself.
I feel kind of bad, I admitted. This place isn't doing so well, and now we're damaging their property.
That's what insurance is for, said Ms. Terwilliger. Besides, if it helps us find Jill, I'm sure your queen can make an anonymous donation to this place.
Eddie helped the two of us climb up and get through the window, and then he followed deftly on his own. Inside, the gallery was empty and quiet, exactly how it was during regular business hours. The dim glow from the exit signs, as well as illumination from the street lamps outside, provided enough light for us to see by, once we gave our eyes some time to adjust. We went immediately to the Raptorbot exhibit, and this time I let Ms. Terwilliger cast an unlocking spell on the glass door. After she finished, I wondered for a moment if there might be some kind of spell on it that was keyed to me again. Then we heard an audible click, and the door swung open. Inside the case, the Raptorbot rested on top of a large stand that also had a door and an interior compartment.
No lock,
I said, reaching to pull open the smaller door. "Sydney, wait," began Ms. Terwilliger, but she was too late. I'd already opened it. I froze, expecting the entire thing to explode, but after several tense seconds, nothing happened. I exhaled in relief. "Sorry, I wasn't thinking." She nodded, still ill at ease. "I can still sense that there's some sort of magic here." "Maybe it's the object inside this," I said. I couldn't make out the interior compartment's belongings and tentatively reached my hand into the dark space, half expecting a scorpion to sting me. Instead, my fingertips touched a large manila envelope, which I slowly pulled out. My name was written across it.
"Same handwriting,"
Eddie observed. I nodded in agreement. "Yeah, too bad we don't have an easy way to trace. Do you hear that?" I could tell from Eddie's face that his quicker hearing had already picked it up. Ms. Terwilliger took a little longer to notice. "Like, buzzing." She glanced up into the raptor bot's metal face. "From that!" The buzzing grew louder and louder, and Eddie hurried forward to put himself between the display case and us.
"Get back!"
he shouted, just as the raptor bot's mouth opened and several dozen glowing objects came flying out. They came at us with unbelievable force, and I fell backward, landing awkwardly on my side. I held up my hands to block the glowing swarm, but some of them still grazed my face as they passed by. I cried out at the contact, which stung like a million paper cuts. "What are they?" I managed to exclaim.
"Photianas!"
Ms. Terwilliger called back. She too had hit the floor and was covering her face as the swarm came by for another pass.
"Photi what?"
asked Eddie.
"They're from the same realm Hopper comes from, but they're much less friendly."
She cautiously removed her hands from her face so she could get a line of sight on the creatures.
"Think of them as mutant fireflies."
Eddie, ever ready to improvise, grabbed the welcome sign from the robot standing at the doorway. Wielding it like a baseball bat, he swung it toward the Photianas as they came toward him. As though they shared one mind, the swarm parted so that his bat hit mostly open air. Only a couple of the Photianas were too slow. They disintegrated into sparks as they were struck. That was encouraging at least, but we had a lot more of them to get through. Things grew more complicated when the swarm split into three and came after each of us. I had just gotten to my feet, but as I saw the group targeting me, in an arrow formation even, I tore across the room and managed to duck under the conveyor belt's table just in time.
"What's the best way to get rid of them?"
I yelled to Mr. Williger.
"Fire?"
Across the room, I could see Eddie continuing to nick away at them with his sign, but their speed and agility kept him from making significant progress.
"I don't want to burn this place down,"
she called back, trying to dodge as the swarm chasing her passed nearby. They swiped her arm, leaving tears in her sleeve and small bloody cuts visible on the skin beneath. As soon as she had some distance between her and them, she held up her hands and chanted a Latin incantation I'd never heard before. 100 tiny sparkling crystals appeared in the air before her, and with another command, she sent them flying into the Photianas. Where the crystals struck, the mutant fireflies vanished into sparks. The swarm chasing me flew low, trying to run me out from under my table. I waved them off, getting my hand stung in the process, as I parsed Mr. Williger's spell. It had been very similar in word and feel to my old friend the fireball spell, with just a few notable differences. It was an ice spell, I realized. Thrown with enough force, bits of ice could have the impact of little razors. I scurried out from under my table and tried to put some space between my swarm and me. Behind me, I heard Ms. Terwilliger once again reciting the spell. Hoping I had the words memorized, I attempted the same feat, using the same motions and gestures I would for the fireball spell. Power coursed through me, and ice crystals shot forward at my command. But my aim wasn't as good as Mr. Williger's. Although the spell's structure was similar to that of the fireball, the feel of it was different and required practice. I only managed to take out a few of the Photianas that time, but had more success on my second and third attempts. Whenever I paused to recast, they wasted no chance to come at me, causing more irritation and pain. I would wave them off and cast the spell again, gradually picking off their numbers. I lost track of time until I caught sight of a second cluster of ice crystals joining mine as I sent them into the significantly smaller Photiana flock. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Ms. Terwilliger waving her hands. A moment later, Eddie came striding forward as well, still wielding that sign. They'd both defeated their respective swarms. Mine was the only one left, and within minutes, my friends helped me finish off the last of them. Without the buzzing, the room suddenly took on an eerie silence. We all stood still, chests rising and falling heavily, as we looked around the dim room for any further signs of danger. Eddie and Ms. Terwilliger's faces both showed cuts and scrapes where the Photianas had touched them, and from the stinging of my own skin, I assumed I looked the same. We were alive, though, and the threat seemed to be neutralized for now.
"Where's the envelope?"
Eddie asked at last. I hurried over to where I'd dropped it, back by the raptor bot, who had just surveyed our altercation from his lofty display. The ice crystals had melted into puddles on the floor, and one corner of the envelope was soaked as a result. Otherwise, it seemed undamaged. I carried it over to my friends and turned to Ms. Terwilliger before opening it. "Do you sense anything?" I asked.
"If there's a spell, it's very cleverly concealed."
She held up her hand, and a small burst of fire appeared in her palm.
"I'll be ready, just in case."
The envelope was heavy and bulky, so I wasn't entirely surprised when I found a brick inside, even though I had no clue what its purpose could be. It appeared to be made out of some sort of sandstone. I glanced at my companions to see if it made sense to them, but they looked as puzzled as I felt. I reached back into the envelope and pulled out a map of the Missouri Ozarks.
"I really didn't expect that," I remarked, scanning it for any writing or clues.
There were none. Anger filled Eddie's features, laced with something I felt too. Disappointment. I hadn't known what we'd discover here, but there'd been a secret part of me that had hoped for a miracle and that we'd find Jill herself. Instead, all we had to show for this trip were some cuts and more cryptic clues. I shook the envelope. It felt empty.
"What on earth could this mean?"
mused Ms. Terwilliger, taking the map from me.
"It means someone's playing with us,"
growled Eddie. He wiped a hand over his sweaty forehead, smearing blood in the process.
"For all we know, Jill isn't even involved in this, and someone's just making us think they have her."
I peered inside the envelope, and my heart sank when I realized it wasn't empty after all.
"I'm afraid not."
I reached into it and pulled out the envelope's last item. Even in the poor lighting, there was no mistaking what this was. A lock of long, curling, light brown hair. And there was no question to whom it belonged.
"Whoever's doing this, they definitely have Jill."
Chapter 5. Adrian. It took every bit of my already questionable self-control not to constantly text and call Sydney for updates. I hadn't realized how hard her absence would hit me. It wasn't just missing her, though that was certainly part of it. I'd gotten used to waking up to her every morning, to seeing her around for meals and other ordinary parts of life. Now, I didn't just have to pass the time without her. I had to also constantly reassure myself that she wasn't in the clutches of the alchemists. "I shouldn't have let her go alone," I told my mom the next day. She glanced up from her cross-stitching. It was a hobby she'd taken up to pass the time, and was only slightly less astonishing than everything else going on in our lives recently. "You worry too much, darling. If there's one thing I can say about my human daughter-in-law, it's that she's shockingly resourceful." I stopped my pacing. You really think so? A wry smile played over my mom's lips. Are you surprised that I'd have something nice to say about her? A little, yeah, I admitted. My mother had never openly protested my relationship with Sydney. Really, there'd been no chance. I'd simply shown up at court with a bride in tow, and no one had been able to put asunder those whom the state of Nevada had brought together. My mom hadn't exactly embraced Sydney with open arms, but she'd also stood with us when others, including my own father, had turned their backs on us. I'd always assumed my mom didn't approve, but was simply making the best of a bad situation. I'd be lying if I said that I'd ever, at any point in my life, wished for you to marry a human, she said after a moment of consideration. I do, however, know that the road you walk in life isn't an easy one. It never has been. It never will be. I've realized that since you were a child, and I've also known that whomever you end up with would have to be someone very special, someone capable of facing those challenges with you. This girl, Sydney, she's someone like that. I've gathered that much in this last month, and I'd rather you have a worthy partner who's a human than a Maroi who can't help you share your burdens. My jaw nearly hit the floor. Mom, I think that's the most sentimental thing I've ever heard you say. Hush, she said, and stop worrying. She's competent and talented. And she's not alone. She's got a guardian, and that strange human woman with her. I managed a faint smile, but couldn't bring myself to tell my mom that Sydney, no matter how competent and talented, hadn't been able to elude the alchemists before. In fact, when she'd initially been captured, Eddie had been with her. He'd been deadly and fierce as usual, but it hadn't been enough. A knock at the door saved me from further rumination, but presented a host of other new problems. I'd promised Nina we could go looking for Olive later, but that was still a few hours away. Sonia had assured me the sedative she'd given Nina to help her sleep would last a while, but for all I knew, it had worn off and I'd find Nina outside my door with those crazy eyes, demanding we go dreaming right now. But when I opened the door, it was Rose I found instead. I wasn't sure whether to feel relieved or be on my guard. Last I'd known, she'd been away from court. Hey, I said. What's up? She was clearly off duty now, dressed casually in jeans and a t-shirt as opposed to the black and white suits guardians wore for formal occasions. She tossed her mane of dark brown hair over one shoulder and grinned. I heard how you've been locked away up here, so I thought I'd come spring you guys. I tried not to wince at you guys. I thought you and Dimitri were away looking for Jill, I said, hoping to deflect the attention off of us. Some of her enthusiasm dimmed at that. We were, but we weren't having much luck. So Lyssa had us come back and look into a few royals who've always been against her, in case they might have abducted Jill. That was news. You think there's any truth to it? Probably not, said Rose. And Lyssa knows it's a long shot, too, but she wants to exhaust every lead. I stepped back. Well, I don't want to hold you up from that. Her grin returned. You aren't. We already put in some hours today and can't do anything else until one of the lords in question gets back tomorrow. So now we're doing something else productive. Grab Sydney, and I'll show you. She's, asleep right now, I lied. Asleep? It's the middle of the day. Our day, I corrected. She's still on a human schedule. Rose looked understandably floored. Really? Last time I was here, I thought she'd adapted pretty nicely. She misses the sun, I explained. Does she actually go out? Well, no, but it's the principle of the matter. It's a human thing. Judging from Rose's increasingly baffled expression, I really wasn't doing a good job of covering for us here, so I decided to cut my losses. Look, why don't you show me whatever you've got, and I'll leave a note for Sydney? I figured that was better than Rose possibly offering to wait around until Sydney woke up. Sure, said Rose. We can get her out another time. I gestured her toward the hallway. After you. Don't you need to leave the note? She asked pointedly. Right. Hang on. I stepped back inside and left Rose out in the hall. After standing there for about half a minute, I opened the door again and joined her. All set? Rose took me to a section of court generally reserved for guardian activities. It was near their headquarters and some of their housing. More importantly, it was where they trained, and it was to one of their training fields she led me now. Only, when we arrived, it wasn't a group of Dompiers we found. It was a group of warrior Moroi. "Well, I'll be damned," I said. I meant it as a compliment. Ages ago, during the time humans and Moroi